This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an update on Amnesty International's recent report on tasers with our own Dalia Hashad.
The figures actually are quite shocking. Well over 300 people killed by tasers in the last 7 years. It's an epidemic.
We'll discuss the recent victory of the laid-off workers from Republic Windows and Doors.
A great victory for the workers, but even more, it may be opening a new chapter in American activism. People are getting more courageous, open, and fighting for their rights.
We'll discuss the recent verdict against the Holy Land Charity that is bound to have a chilling effect on the Muslim community. We'll speak with journalist Leila El-Aryan and also Linda Moreno, an attorney in the case. We'll also hear excerpts from a New York University Law School event titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era. Stay with us.
Heidi and Michael, what did you think about the shoe-throwing incident with Bush in Iraq?
It was incredible. I mean, it's made so many people feel hopeful and want to join on in support of this really courageous act.
Right, courageous act. He was in the middle of all these reporters. Bush is at the podium. He takes off his shoe, which is apparently the greatest insult you can have in Iraq, is to throw your shoe because it's really considered the dirtiest part because it's on the ground all the time. And he throws it at Bush. Bush ducks. And, of course, the courageous reporter, who's 28 years old, then got taken out and had the heck beaten out of him, is in prison and is going to be arraigned in the next few days as to what his charges will be. But what's extraordinary about it, not only is courage, I mean, that's really courageous in that because you know you're going to be beaten, if not murdered, is that the support for him all over Iraq and all over the world for this courageous act. And that really is an indication of, I think, the changes that we're seeing in this country, as we talked about the strike in Chicago, people sitting down, and the opening up, really, of maybe a people's democracy in a way that's very special.
And I think it's because he was so brave in knowing what the consequences would be and yet acting anyway. And essentially, he's saying what so many of us in the States want to say about Bush.
He said, "Bush, you dog." And they said, and then we threw the second shoe. He said, "This is for the widows and the orphans that you've made." And they hauled him off and they were beating him. And he was screaming in pain in the other room. And you could hear it in the room Bush was in. And Bush then went on with his speech. It was perfectly emblematic of 8 years of the presidency of Bush.
It was an act of moral fortitude.
And it's inspired the whole Muslim world. It's inspired lawyers all over the world. It's inspired our own lawyers in the National Lawyers Guild, dozens of whom came forward wanting to represent him. And finally, he was able to get the best lawyer in Iraq who's representing him. So I think it's that kind of support that's going to save that guy's life.
In another update, we were also thrilled to hear that on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was on December 10th of this year, they gave human rights awards to a half a dozen people, and it's the most significant one they give. They only give it every 5 years, and it's on a 60th anniversary. And they gave one to our own New York City lawyer, radical, a person we've interviewed on Lawyers You'll Like, Ramsey Clark. And that's really amazing because Ramsey, he's not just a human rights lawyer. He's just not a civil liberties lawyer. Ramsey is a serious, radical lawyer. And that he got this award by the United Nations is a real statement.
I thought that being recognized by a body that represents the world is just the greatest tribute to one of the great lawyers in this country. It was really fitting and very moving that he got that.
Indeed, it's another positive development that gives us hope for the next few years.
A third update we want to bring you is what we call the net getting tighter, or something like that, or jail facing some of our higher-level officials. In the last few days, you know, we've been having this debate on the so-called left and in the human rights community about what should Obama do? Should there be truth commissions? Should there be nothing? Should there be prosecutions? And the more progressive among us have said there have to be prosecutions. Truth commissions are just an excuse. Nothing will happen. And it's because you're thinking that politics is static and you actually can't change Obama, but Obama is not God. He's not ruling here. It's the people that should be ruling. And so we at the center and in other organizations, the Guild as well, have insisted on prosecutions of Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld, the whole crowd. And we've had a few incredible developments that is actually shifting this in our favor of prosecutions. That's not saying there won't be pardons, and we'll can mention that, but it's shifting in favor of prosecutions. First, you had this report from a bipartisan committee in the Senate, the Senate Armed Forces Committee, which is chaired by Levin. The minority is headed by McCain. 25 senators, Republicans and Democrats, came out with their report saying first that at bottom of the torture conspiracy, the torture program, is Donald Rumsfeld. This isn't bad apples. This is Donald Rumsfeld. This is Republicans and Democrats. Secondly, they're saying that what was used here, these so-called SEER techniques, which are the techniques that they developed for U.S. people to learn how to resist torture, which were then used on detainees, those were actually designed to elicit false confessions. False confessions that could then be used by government. In this case, the report said the Chinese government, who knows, but reports by governments so that they could have false trials of people and put people on television. So they're actually designed to get false confessions. And thirdly, what this joint report said, and this is Levin saying, again, he's ahead of a lot of human rights groups whose names I would like to name because they've been stalling on going after Bush, Cheney, and company by saying, oh, we need truth commissions, we need this, we need that, what we need is prosecutions. What Levin said was, I want the DOD, Department of Defense, and the new administration to hold accountable those individuals involved in this program. That's a call for prosecutions. And here you have Levin outstripping and out ahead of the Washington inside the Beltway liberals. And it's the usual thing I've had for 40 years of how you're inside Washington, you're inside the Beltway, you're also outside of the politics that matter. And so I was really pleased to see that report. And then as we walked into the studio today, was Cheney essentially confessed to being the architect of the, or one of the architects of the torture program, including waterboarding. He did it on national TV. He did it in a broadcast in which he's asked about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who has waterboarded secret sites. And he basically says, I was involved in that program. I got it through. That's what I did. And as a friend of mine who actually was supporting, surprisingly, truth commissions, Scott Horton recently wrote a blog that now says that essentially Cheney has confessed to a felony. And what that means is you don't need a truth commission here. You need an indictment.
That's right.
That's what it's about. And Cheney has confessed. And it all leads up to you really wonder what's going on, and I wonder myself, are these guys now really setting themselves up for pardons? You have the Levin Senate report really saying Rumsfeld's a crook, practically saying that. You have Cheney admitting he's a crook. And then you got the president with 20-some more days or 30 more days left in office. And, of course, pardons normally come on the last day of the presidency. And there may be a generic pardon for what we call the torture conspirators.
Stay tuned.
We haven't given an update recently on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the award-winning journalist who our listeners know has been on death row for about 26 years. Procedurally, his case is at the stage where his attorney, Robert Bryan, the lead attorney on Mumia's case, is getting ready to file a petition for a writ of certiorari before the United States Supreme Court. Now, as listeners may or may not know, these writs are usually denied just due to the sheer volume that are submitted to the Supreme Court. But there are several issues, especially the so-called Batson claim, which deals with the issue of jurors being excluded impermissibly on the basis of their race. In Mumia's case, several black jurors were disqualified. The filing for the writ of cert basically represents the last step in Mumia's case. And so this is a really critical juncture, and one in which the people's movement in the streets can really help raise attention worldwide to his plight.
An important update, there were worldwide protests about Mumia last week, all throughout cities, Vienna, Berlin, other places by the Mumia movement. And it's interesting that there's almost a stronger movement in Europe in terms of demonstrations than there are here. But the one in Berlin was quite significant. There was one a few years ago where there were thousands. There weren't thousands again, but there was at least 1,000. And they marched from one of the more famous places in Berlin, Kreuzberg, one of the more interesting progressive communities. They marched from there to the Brandenburg Gate. And the Brandenburg Gate, of course, was the entrance between East and West Berlin. It was a statue of victory in some way. It wasn't the victory statue. And the American embassy was right there. Hundreds of people marched down the avenue. And as a writer recently said, they were protesting really the racism in this country, in the United States, put Mumia to death. And they were doing it at the symbol, or close to the symbol, really, of racism in Germany that put millions to death under Hitler. And so it was a really very, apparently, a very moving demonstration. And it capped a week of activities in Germany where you had a group, The Clash, played. You had all kinds of incredible activities in Germany. And so it is an indication, really, an important indication that Mumia, despite his 27 years, is that right, I think, Heidi?
Yes.
27 years in prison, there is still a live movement protesting, really, a racist death penalty against this important African-American journalist Mumia.
And also, listeners may remember about a year and a half ago, Paris, France actually named a street Rue Mumia. And the Police Benevolent Association in the United States petitioned to the government of France to rescind it. But of course, the enlightened French did not.
I should also say the activities in Germany included Amnesty International, PEN, Günter Grass was there, and there was a showing. I don't know if you've seen the film, Heidi, the British film In Prison, My Whole Life.
I have seen it, and that a lot of people may not know about it. A young man who happened to be born on the day Mumia was arrested. His mother talked about Mumia as he was growing up as a young man, and he decided that he wanted to make a movie drawing the comparisons of a man who had been incarcerated while he had grown up, essentially, from a baby to an adult. And he met with Mumia. The film is really an extraordinary work that talks about that, but also interviews a lot of literary figures in the United States, political figures, talks about the death penalty, and talks in detail about Mumia's case. There's also a book that we've discussed on Law and Disorder, The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal by Patrick O'Connor.
Dalia Hashada, our co-host, you have been working on the Taser disaster for several years now, and I understand there's a new report out. Tell us about it.
This report took a comprehensive look at deaths that we have tracked from June 2001 through the end of this summer, August 2008. So at that point, it was 334 deaths that have resulted after a taser has been applied in police custody.
Between what years?
June 2001, ending August 2008.
And this is all in the United States?
All in the United States.
Say that number again, because that is huge.
334, but there have been more. And
wow.
The months subsequent, we just haven't reviewed those autopsies
oh
yet.
Oh my gosh!
And this is the purposeful electrical shocking of somebody to subdue them, and it's sold as an alternative to lethal force.
People think of taser as kind of a shock, an electric shock, but I think people don't really understand what it means to get tasered by police. There are two ways to get tasered. One's up close stun drive mode, where they just kind of place the taser on your up close on your skin and they shock you. But then there's the other more common way where it's fired from a distance and you've got compressed nitrogen throwing out these darts at over 120 miles an hour. These are two darts that are shaped like fish hooks. They can penetrate about 2 inches of clothing and they penetrate skin and they hook into your skin. They're attached to insulated wires. When they hook into your skin, it creates a circuit, and electricity, 50,000 volts of electricity, can then start flowing through your body. And what it does is it interrupts your ability to control your muscles, and you completely lose capacity to control your own body. It's extremely painful. Now, what we're seeing in these deaths that we've studied, the 334, is that we're seeing police officers are not just shooting people once with the taser and not doing it in situations where there are no lesser alternatives, but they're doing it in all sorts of situations where there's no need to do it. They're shooting people multiple times, again and again and again, and certainly in instances where there's no cause to do something like this.
What is the cause of death for these 334 people who have been killed in the last 7 years? What does the taser do to kill people?
Out of 334 cases, in 50 cases, coroners or medical examiners said that the taser was either the cause of death, or if it wasn't the cause of death, then it contributed to the death. So, for example, the case of Baron Pikes that a lot of people remember, he was from Winnfield, Louisiana, and he was, police say they encountered him on the street. They wanted to arrest him for an outstanding drug warrant, and he started to walk away. When he started to go away, he was taken to the ground, handcuffed behind his back, and then the officer shocked him 9 times. Unfortunately, this man died. The medical examiner who looked at the body and examined, did the autopsy and did the report, said, it appears that this man was being shocked even after he died. He thinks he might have died after the 7th shock. When he was already apprehended on the ground, handcuffed, the medical examiner took a look at this case, and he said that apparently that what was done to this man was tantamount to torture.
What does it do, stop a person's heart?
Some doctors say this. What this can do is if it hits you at the exact wrong time, it's like playing Russian roulette with your heart. It can interfere with your heartbeat. That's part of the problem that we're kind of guessing here. There hasn't been the independent medical research that we need that's really been done comprehensively on this weapon to tell us what's happened, what it does when it hits the human body. We've introduced it backwards. We put it out on the streets, and now that people are dropping dead, we're trying to ask questions about how this happened and why it happened.
Do you think they should be withdrawn?
Yeah, I think what needs to happen is we need tasers off the streets. And if they're not going to be pulled off the streets of police departments, which, and each police department gets to decide individually whether they're going to pull them or keep them on the streets. But what we need to do is if the police department is going to keep the tasers in their force, then they need to put them on the use of force continuum, that's in a place that says you can only use this where there are absolutely no lesser alternatives available, and you may never use in a nonviolent situation. We are seeing instances where police officers are using the taser weapon on someone for talking back, on someone who refuses to comply with a police order quickly enough. We're seeing people who have medical conditions, and because they're physically unable to comply with the police officer quickly enough, the police are shooting them with a taser.
How many states or police forces use tasers? Is almost everybody?
About 12,000 across the nation, and it's not just police forces, you know, out on the street coming into contact with civilians. Believe it or not, it's inside jails.
Tell us about the Amnesty campaign, how people can get information, how they can get this booklet. Once
AmnestyUSA.org.
Okay, AmnestyUSA.org/taser abuse. When you go to that campaign, what are you asking people to do?
The best way that you can impact this issue is to act locally, because police departments are going to be more responsive to local pressure. So there is information up on the website about things you can do. Get in contact, find out where your local Amnesty International office is, your regional office, and they will have a whole packet for you of things you can do and ways you can respond to local taser incidents or ways that you can interact with your police department and pressure them to stop using the taser weapon.
Well, thank you, Dayu Hashad, our co-host and from Amnesty International, for a coverage of a story that we've been covering continuously over the last few years on the incredibly horrible use of tasers.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Last week, angry laid-off workers from Republic Windows and Doors agreed to leave the closed Illinois plant they've occupied in protest for 6 days. The workers accepted a new deal that will give each of them about $6,000, accrued vacation time, and 2 months of health care coverage. About $1.75 million will be put into an escrow account to be supervised by the workers' union. Union leaders say it's a bittersweet deal because workers at the Republic still lose their jobs in a climate where none are to be found. Most of the workers who occupied the factory made about $30,000 a year. Their organization and protest drew international attention and put a human face on the current economic recession. We have with us today Paul Buell, senior lecturer at Brown University, a historian of American radicalism, a former member of Students for a Democratic Society, and author of many books, including Images of American Radicalism. Welcome, Paul, to Law and Disorder.
Of course.
2 weeks ago, the workers at a Chicago plant that manufactured doors and windows, kind of a green plant because these were energy-efficient doors and windows. They had formed a union 4 years ago. They were making about $14.50 an hour. There were over 300 workers in this plant. The plant was making a profit. But the Bank of America, which extended credit to the manufacturer, cut off their credit line. And as a consequence, they closed their doors. And they were supposed to, under law, give the workers either 60 days notice that they were going to be let go or give them 60 days pay. The workers were told, you're going to be let go in 3 days. Goodbye. The workers demanded a meeting with management. They went to the factory to have that meeting. Management didn't even bother to show up. And the workers said, you know, we're going to sit in here and we're going to get that 2 months back pay that we're owed, and we're going to get some health insurance, and we're not moving until management shows up and gives us what we are legally obliged to get. Take the story on from there, Paul. What are the implications of that kind of direct action?
My pronouncement as a labor historian, most interested in the IWW on the one hand, and the corruption and various limitations of the mainstream American labor movement on the other hand, is simply that the sit-down strike goes all the way back to its invention by the Wobblies in 1907 in Schenectady. Not much happened from that we know of, a few incidents, but basically it became the organizing mechanism of the CIO in the 1930s along the same original principle. Why stand outside and slug it out with the cops or scabs when you could be inside defending your job and making sure that nobody could charge you with breaking the machinery? And there's a direct line from the sit-down strike to the sit-in of the 1950s and the teach-in of the 1960s and 1970s. And the fact that Obama welcomed it, as opposed to the Petco response of Reagan to fire a bunch of people, indicates that we have entered a new era. The nation has acquired more political oxygen than it's had in a long time, and there's a spirit of empowerment which seemed through the election period to be waiting for something wonderful to happen from on high, but now may have entered a phase where people feel the possibility of doing something in the situation immediately around them, something rather remarkable, which one wouldn't have dared do during the Bush or Reagan eras, maybe not the Clinton era either, but which now seems simple and logical, especially given the economic meltdown and the social crisis that's bound to develop from it.
That's a really important perception. I'd like you to explore where you think we might go with that in the next period. I mean, in the past, you know, we've had a real repression of dissent in the country, from pens to tasers to charges of terrorism. And now we're seeing here a sit-down. And how do you see it going forward, Paul?
I think, if I'm being optimistic, and I am these days, I think that the fact that they occupied the plant, did it peacefully, and were successful will inspire people to believe that they can likewise make their own collective, not individual private property collective, but their own collective possession of the places that they work or the places that they live or neighborhood they live in or other situations in which we work there, we live there. So in a large social sense, not exactly in corporate law, those places belong to us, and we human beings need those places. And moreover, as students occupying universities many years ago, we held counter classes and did a lot of learning. Likewise, we can move things forward socially much better than those who have been in charge and have been keeping their foot upon us. So it's a moment for extraordinarily creative thinking and long and possibly boring meetings, but drawing upon energy of people that weren't aware they had the energy or weren't aware that they would ever have the opportunity to use that energy. In a world where office parties are being canceled because there isn't enough corporate property, maybe a different attitude toward work and who owns the jobs and what the jobs mean will now develop.
You know, Paul, carrying on your thought, the victory at Republic Door and Window was a great one, but it could have gone even further if you think about it. That plant is being closed down, and those 330-some workers and their families are going to be out of work probably for a long, long time. But what if it would have gone this way? What if the workers would have said, you know, the government just gave away $750 billion to all the big banks, including the Bank of America, which cut off their credit. What if we demand that the credit be restored to Republic and that this place be taken over by us and that we run it and that we make the decisions? That seems to be the logic of their actions.
I quite agree. There's a long history going back in the U.S., at any rate, to the Knights of Labor in the 1880s, where textile workers took over specific plants. I'm thinking of a big one in Rhode Island, and announced to management that they could do the manufacturing process much more successfully themselves, with much less waste and assorted problems, and did so for several months until management came to the conclusion that it was set a terrible example and had to be crushed, and was crushed amidst the fears and Red Scare after the Haymarket incident on May 18, 1886. And there are other kinds of circumstances in which those things have been have happened for at least brief periods of time. And I want to point out a proposal by a fellow named Mark Nason, who teaches at Fordham in the Bronx, based upon his reading of the 1930s and 40s things and his experience in the Bronx, which is, now is a moment when abandoned factories or abandoned community places could quite successfully be occupied by groups that call for resources to be created for them and then proceed to do what's necessary to bring these things back up to speed and make them living spaces rather than just being dead and empty, and invitations to firebugs and so on.
Precisely. I think that when Congress gave away all those hundreds of billions of dollars, they gave it away with no strings attached. And if there was a people's movement out there, they would be the strings, and they would say, you're not giving it to them. We're going to decide where that money goes. That money could be used to reinvigorate these abandoned homes and factories, manufacturing places, where democracy could come from the bottom up, and the resources of this country would be in the control of people who actually work, and not the bankers who are now sitting on top of it.
I think that's true, and the extreme amount of publicity, briefly, maybe not so briefly, given to the incident in Chicago, in Rachel Maddow's a great example, Keith Olderman also, of showing to millions of people that it can be done. So the moment is here, and maybe there's much too much expectation waiting for the inauguration. But I think in some other sense, the pervasive crisis from Iraq and Afghanistan to the home front calls for the kind of response that people feel ordinarily isn't possible or isn't necessary. My old professor at Wisconsin, William Appleton Williams, used to say, as the supreme historian of empire as he was, that until the empire goes into crisis, everything seems sort of okay, or at least you can't do anything about it. And it's great to be at the center of the empire. That's where all the goodies are. and then the empire goes into crisis because of some foreign misadventure, and then the reality of the whole system with its many unfreedoms down to the most intimate level becomes clear to a very large number of people who are capable of taking their own initiative.
Paul Buell, radical American historian. What's your latest book?
There are two. One is, I'm editor, not artist, Che, a graphic biography by Spain Rodriguez. And the second one is Isadora Duncan, a graphic biography by Sabrina Jones.
Oh, how great.
They're more fun to read in comic.
And who published them?
In the first case, Verso. In the second case, Hill and Wang.
Thanks, Paul. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last month, a jury in Dallas, Texas, found five Palestinian men guilty of more than 100 charges in the nation's largest terrorism financing trial since 9/11. We talk with Leila Alarian, a Washington-based journalist who recently wrote a powerful alternate article about this case and its impact on Muslim charities. We also talk with Linda Moreno, one of the lawyers in the case. As many listeners may know, Holy Land was the largest Muslim charity in the United States. The Bush administration shut it down after the September 11th attacks and arrested five officials from the charity. In her article, Alarian describes how the prosecution introduced unrelated and inflammatory video to emotionally sway the jurors. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
This was the second trial against Holy Land. Can you briefly describe what happened in the first trial?
Sure. Basically, five Palestinian-American men were arrested because they were at one point either worked for or were founders of the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development, which is the largest American Muslim charity until it was closed in December of 2001. This charity gave over $50 million to needy people all over the world, including Bosnia, including victims of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, as well as Palestinians who were living in the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza. And even in the indictment, if you look at what the men were actually charged with doing, the U.S. government actually admits that all of that money, the $12 million that was donated to Palestinians, all went to charity, all went to needy people, whether it was hospitals or libraries or school supplies or even just providing food and shelter to needy Palestinians. However, the government's theory is that this money is fungible and that by giving it to Zakat committees that were supposedly tied to Hamas, that actually freed up money for violence. Now, what's interesting is that these same Zakat committees, the U.S. government, USAID, and the International Red Cross also donated to. What the defendants say is that there's absolutely no connection between the Zakat committees and Hamas, and that the government failed to prove that connection. Now, the first trial last year, after a month of deliberations, the jury came back and there was a mistrial. Initially, all the jurors wanted to acquit the defendants, the vast majority of charges. However, one juror, after the jury was pulled, changed her mind. And when you actually see interviews with William Neal, one of the jurors who was really pushing for full acquittal of the defendants, he said that this woman was obstinate. She refused to say why she wanted to convict the men. She relied basically on her gut feelings, and that was why she was pushing for conviction. So the trial ended in mistrial, and this past September, the men were retried once again in Dallas, Texas. And there was a different jury, of course, and this time they came back with full convictions against everyone.
Now, that's what we want to sort of get at. How do you explain the different outcomes?
That's actually something that Linda Moreno, one of the defense attorneys, said. You know, it's mind-boggling how in one trial a jury comes back with no convictions against anybody, and in the second trial you have every single person was convicted of all the charges. I think what happens if you talk to people who are, you know, who either tried the case or observed it. I went to Dallas, Texas as a producer with Al Jazeera English, and I spoke with a lot of the supporters, people who were carrying banners every single day saying that charity to orphans is not a crime and that, you know, do you ask a child what his religion is before you feed him, these types of things. And they said that it was basic fear-mongering by the government. They were showing a lot of videos that were supposedly Hamas-affiliated that were showing things that I think to the Western eye may look disturbing, but if you've been living under occupation for decades and decades, you know, this is sort of what happens.
Give us an example.
Such as, you know, kindergartners reenacting military situations, wearing military fatigues, things like that. They were also showed videos of bus bombings. I think at one point the government recreated a bus bombing and they showed that video. And of course the government didn't even allege that the men had any connection to violence. But this was simply fear-mongering. They also brought in two witnesses from Israel. One of them was testified as an expert witness. His name is Avi. That's his pseudonym. We don't actually know what his real name is. and he was a Shin Bet agent. And he, no one knows his real name, like I said. And from what the defense attorneys tell me, this is the first time that they know of in any American courtroom that an expert witness, not a fact witness, testified under a pseudonym. No one knows his real identity.
There are multiple problems with that, obviously. How do we hold such a person accountable for perjury?
Absolutely. Also, the defense attorneys, how are you going to cross-examine someone when you don't even know who he is? You don't know his background. You're not able to research who he is. You know, he could commit perjury and he won't face any kind of consequences. And the defense attorneys did prove that he ended up lying to the jury about the Zakat committees being tied to Hamas. The other person who came from Israel was named Major Lior. Again, it was a pseudonym. And he was the person who commanded one of the operations in the West Bank. I think it was against the Jenin refugee camp. And that's when some of these, you know, so-called evidence trying to connect the Zakat committees to Hamas were seized. And again, I mean, this is someone, you're in a situation of war, situation of occupation, and you're bringing people in who have a clear stake in this political situation. So you're, what you're really doing is you're prosecuting the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in an American courtroom, which a lot of people are disturbed by.
Prosecutors told the jury that the programs were controlled by Hamas, which is listed as a terrorist organization by the State Department. But Edward Abington, who's the former number two intelligence official, told jurors that he was not told that the Palestinian charity committees supported by Holy Land were part of Hamas.
Right. Well, if the U.S. government really believed that these Zakat committees, and I should just define the word Zakat, it means charity in Arabic. It's one of the five major pillars of Islam. So for Muslims, giving charity is a religious obligation. And this Holy Land Foundation was one of the premier Muslim charities in America. So after this charity was shut down, I mean, it really limits people's options as far as where to donate, where to help needy people. So if the U.S. government really believed these Zakat committees were in fact tied to Hamas, A, they would have designated the Zakat committees in their designations. And you know, our government is never, he never hesitates to do that if they really had the evidence. And secondly, we wouldn't donate to these very same Zakat committees. That's what's so mind-boggling about this case, is that we ourselves are giving money to these organizations that were... So it's a clear case of selective prosecution. And also, the way we're, the U.S. government is trying to prove that these are indeed Hamas-affiliated is through the testimony of an Israeli witness. That testimony cannot be authenticated because he is anonymous. And B, it's a situation of war where he clearly has a stake in this, and it's obviously in his best interest to say whatever the government wants him to say.
What is the next step in terms of legal proceedings? Will there be an appeal?
There will be an appeal. There are very strong grounds for appeal, including this disturbing and unprecedented testimony by an anonymous Israeli Shin Bet agent who was an expert witness. We don't know what happened in the jury room, so if it turns out that there was any kind of, you know, intimidation or anything, that would be grounds for appeal. So I know the lawyers are definitely confident that this could get turned over on appeal, but as you know, That could take a while. Now, the sentencing will probably be sometime in the spring, so I'm confident that, you know, that will also be, they'll make a very strong case that, you know, there were a lot of very troubling things that happened in the case. Shouldn't be sentenced harshly.
Now, what effect is this going to have on other charities, do you think?
Well, not only are Muslim charities worried, but I think even non-Muslim charities are worried, given, like I mentioned, the International Red Cross gives to these very same Zakat committees in the Palestinian territories. So I think there definitely is a chilling effect. I think people are worried that they're next. I think that's part of the reason why these cases are prosecuted, because they are such high-profile cases. President Bush himself commented on it. Joe Lieberman, the senator, even commented on the verdict, saying that it was a great day for America or something to that respect. So I think these cases are really used to instill fear in people's hearts and hesitancy as far as actually getting involved and donating to people who need it the most. I mean, look at what's happening in Gaza today. People are without power, without food, without jobs, and they need this type of aid more than ever. But my fear is that it's going to dry up, and this is, like I said, we're prosecuting the conflict in an American courtroom, and all they want is to try to punish people who are suffering and to punish those who want to help them.
Leila, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
We're now joined by Linda Marino to discuss more of the details in the Holy Land case. Linda, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. So good to be with you.
You were one of the defense attorneys in the Holy Land case. Can you describe what role you played?
I represent Ghassan Alashi. Mr. Alashi was the chairman of the board of the Holy Land Foundation. He was with the Holy Land Foundation from its inception until its closure in 2001, a period of 12 years.
Were you involved in the first trial?
I was. I was his counsel in the first trial, which you may know ended in a series of acquittals on several counts, and the jury hung on all the rest.
Obviously, we had two different juries, two different outcomes. Was the presentation of evidence different in the second trial?
It was somewhat different, both from the defense perspective and from the prosecution. But really, the prosecution's case was really quite similar. And in fact, although they said that they had pared down their evidence, it really took about the same period of time. In this particular retrial, they introduced who they called an insider, a convicted felon who talked about the Holy Land case and made the bald assertion that the Holy Land knew that these Zakat committees were Hamas and funneled money to the Zakat committees because they were Hamas. We proved in cross-examination, of course, that was not true and really speculative on his part. And additionally, this was a witness who pled guilty to a charge that carried an incarcerative term of life. And by the time he had been testifying in the Holy Land trial, after testifying in the Mohammed Salah case in Chicago, his sentence was now down to 92 months. So he was working off his sentence in his testimonies at these various trials.
That's quite an incredible downward departure in his sentencing.
Right, from life to 92 years. And as I told the jury in closing, he wasn't done yet. We may see Mr. Shorbaji making an appearance, a cameo in other trials around the country, unfortunately.
Now, I'm aware that there was videotape evidence that may have been extremely prejudicial.
The government began its case conceding that none of the gentlemen on trial had ever participated in any violence, period. You're also talking about a criminal investigation that lasted 12 years in terms of the wiretap evidence and the surveillance evidence. And my client, Ghassan Alashi, along with the other gentlemen, were never caught on tape extolling the virtue of suicide bombing or any violence. You know, what they were talking about was the Palestinian issue, the horror of the brutal military occupation. The government began its case with its first exhibit, which was a photograph of a bombed-out bus, which, of course, had nothing to do with the accused in the Holy Land case. And they continued to introduce a plethora of extremely inflammatory and prejudicial evidence of violence. In the middle of our trial, a very important decision came down in the Second Circuit of New York called Almoyad. And Almoyad is the first terrorism conviction, Heidi, that has been overturned, reversed. This case was reversed because of this evidence of violence that the government introduced that really had nothing to do with Mr. Almoyad. So when that case came down, we started making what we called the Almoyad objections. And we believe this is an important issue for appeal. There were no videos of suicide bombers, but there were videos of children doing skits. Really, you're talking about an art form that is a result of a culture under occupation.
A culture that is very difficult for Americans to understand.
And as I said to the jury, you know, in America, children, American kids and teenagers, they have violent video games that they can play and play all day long, but they get to turn that off at night, and they get to go back to the safety and sanctuary of their homes and their bedrooms and shut the door. When you're a Palestinian child, you don't have that luxury.
Linda, this brings up a notion of charities under fire. What effect do you think this will have in the future?
Well, I mean, I think that certainly there were charities around the world who were watching what was going on with the Holy Land case. We know, because we proved in the trial, in both trials, that the United States government, through USAID and other organizations, was giving to the exact same Zakat committees that were at issue and at play in the indictment in this case. And the notion that you have to vet the recipient of charitable donations, I believe, is un-American. That's why I believe that the Holy Land case is a case that all Americans should pay attention to and watch very carefully. There's just something wrong about criminalizing humanitarian aid. And I said to the jury, perhaps my client and the other gentleman just fed the wrong people, that Palestinians don't deserve to be helped.
Linda, is your approach going forward going to differ in any way from the previous trials?
I actually will be involved in some other similar trials. What I can tell you for the Holy Land is the next step, of course, is the appeal. We believe it's a very meritorious appeal. There are issues of first impression in this case, and this is a case that may go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. We believe very, very strongly in it.
You're heroes to all of us here on Law and Disorder. This was a huge blow to not only the Palestinian community, but those of us in this country who believe in fairness and justice.
Thank you. To me, the real heroes are these gentlemen.
Yes.
So thank you very much.
Thank you for being on Law and Disorder, Linda.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We go now to hear excerpts from an event at New York University Law School titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era. The event focused on a report written by contributing editor Scott Horton. A panel of legal experts discussed the methods available to a democracy for reckoning with the legacy of human rights abuses. We'll hear from our own Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thank you all for being here. I want to address one point that Bert made about who's going to be pardoned here. If there's going to be pardons, they're not going to be lower-level pardons. They're going to be a generic pardon that says anybody who violated certain laws is hereby pardoned. I mean, that's what I would say. They're not going to name people. They're going to give a generic pardon. And so then we're going to just be, in some sense, out in terms of criminal prosecutions. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to challenge. I agree with Liz. There's challenges, like can the president pardon himself? Or as Scott said once to me, Michael, can co-conspirator pardon other co-conspirators? Those are nice challenges. You know, the pardoning power is pretty broad. But I think, you know, if you look from the first memo of Gonzales, January 25th, 2002, it's all about avoiding criminal prosecution, and not just for the lower guys. It's for the upper guys. That's one thing. The second thing that was mentioned, Liz said she was the only prosecutor on the panel, and that's technically correct, although I did try and prosecute, as you heard, Rumsfeld in both France and in Germany, and we made the world very small for Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, he had to leave Germany immediately after we served the complaint, the criminal prosecutorial complaint. And one thing you should know about pardons is they don't apply to war crimes or to torture. And they may apply here in the United States. We could challenge it on the grounds that the pardons are against international law and against the fact that you cannot pardon war crimes, but they certainly are not going to apply in European prosecutions. So they may protect themselves here and they can walk around, you know, in the United States, but they're not going to walk so freely in Europe. As was said by Luke, our position at the center has been really since the beginning to favor a special prosecutor and to favor prosecutions. We first did a lot with civil cases, as Bert has mentioned. One of our cases, Maher Arar, is being argued. David Cole is actually coming in from the United Kingdom to argue the case. It's the case of the Canadian who was taken to the underground cell in Syria. It's one of the only cases that has even survived this far in terms of civil remedies. It hasn't been very successful. We've tried our German and our French cases again at this point without success, but luckily sitting out there we have Spain and Italy, which currently has 24 CIA agents on trial. So there's some hope. But my basic view here is, assuming there's no pardons in a generic way here, is that there has to be a special prosecutor appointed. And I say that really for a lot of the reasons that have been said. If Obama really said, and his quote is, make sure we don't torture, there's really no way, and I really, it takes up a little bit on Bert's comment, to make sure we don't torture or go off the law the next time around unless there's a deterrence. The deterrence that's used for the smallest crimes, whether it's shoplifting, you know, or a mugging, is the deterrence of criminal prosecution. And the next time a CIA guy or next time a public official says, I want to waterboard somebody or put him in a coffin or give a guy 48 days of sleep deprivation, dogs and stripping, they'll think about it if they know they might get prosecuted. So I really believe you absolutely have to have a special prosecutor here. There's enough information out there. We don't need to know all the information. We know a lot. We have Karen Greenberg's great book, The Torture Papers. Josh Dreitel, I think the co-author, is here. Scores of memos in there, just memo after memo outlining the torture program that this country ran. We have Philip Sands' book. We have Jane Mayer's book, all really outlining the torture program. We know who the principals are. They're the members of the principals committee, the main ones, Tennant, Rumsfeld, Bush, Cheney. That's the principals committee. Then you have the war council, which is the lawyers, Addington, you, Gonzalez, you can name them. They're there. The evidence is there. A prosecutor has enough information here to go forward. And I read Scott's article, and Scott and I, as you can imagine, are quite close and discuss this all the time. And I thought the first half of the article was actually probably one of the best pieces I've read on the torture program in the United States. I mean, it has a line in there that makes you see why you need a criminal deterrence. What he says about the administration is that it waged war against the law itself, which means to say that all the laws you pass in the world, if Obama passes every executive order, if he reverses all of the memos and does all that, the next administration, and even conceivably this one, can figure out, just as Addington and you did, ways to twist the law and make it impossible to make that law applicable. And then you can go to the next step that Scott does describe in here, that they not only did that, but they actually thought they were above the law, that the president wasn't bound by the law, he wasn't bound by Congress, and he wasn't bound by the courts. Well, all the laws in the world can't stop the next president from saying, I'm not bound in the same way that President Bush was bound. The only thing that can do that, really the only thing, is special prosecutions. And so I read Scott's article the first half, where it really, I looked forward to seeing what the second half was going to be. And then I came to the second half, and the second half, it doesn't begin this way, but it starts with, given the political situation in the United States, a commission of inquiry is what we should do. That bothered me a lot, because my view about what our obligation is here as human rights lawyers, as people in the United States, is to insist on what's right and what's proper and what needs to be done to protect us the next time around. And the given political situation in the United States is not static, and it's already shifted, even partly because of this article, mostly in a positive way, because other people are beginning to talk about it, and people are writing op-eds and starting to deal with it. And they're actually, now you see Mukasey twice talk about pardons, because we're changing the political environment. And I'm not saying tomorrow Obama is going to appoint a special prosecutor. I don't know if it'll be him, it'll be the next president or somebody. But it's the right thing to be done here. And I don't like seeing a position taken this early on in the game, particularly based on political efficacy and the fact that that's what we're given the political situation in the United States. So I thought that sent alarm bells off, and I told Scott this, he knows that I didn't like seeing that, especially with the first half of an article that just was really punching at this administration. And then he says this, and then you read what the Commission of Inquiry is like. Scott and I were on a TV show the other day, and after we finished, they said, well, Michael, I think actually Scott's issue here, Scott's Commission of Inquiry, is actually harder to implement than a special prosecutor, because you go through it. It says you need party-affiliated co-chairs. Well, a Republican and a Democrat are going to be the co-chairs of the commission. That's already probably the complete end of the game. Then it says choosing the people is a very difficult problem, and Scott addresses really hard problem. The Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, and minority leaders. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was in on the meeting where she knew waterboarding was being approved. So wait, we can't have that. Then he says, then Scott recognizes that's a problem. We got a problem here. So then he says, a further layer will have a qualifications commission who chooses the candidates that these people then choose. Well, by that time, I'm building a superstructure I just think cannot get through at all. And if you talk about the problems of thinking of an administration that is dealing with all these huge problems out there, the economy, which is what I hear all the time, and everything else, you set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, call it a Commission of Inquiry, which is a much better word here, because there's no reconciliation here. This is not South Africa. This is not South America. This is not a fragile democracy in which there's a military ready to have a coup if we try and prosecute one of them, or at least I hope it's not.
We would welcome the right. coup, actually. Right.
But it's not that. So it's an inappropriate model for that reason as well, but it's certainly inappropriate. It's also inappropriate because even Scott admits in the article, although he says we could get prosecutions out of it eventually, he says it doesn't actually lead to justice. It doesn't seek justice. That's not what a truth commission does. So for all of those reasons, I can give you a lot more, but I really reject that as a model. I do think it's actually harder, that when you talk about wanting to not have the Obama administration divert itself, a three-year truth commission or a three-year commission of inquiry, that's going to be a diversion. A special prosecutor looking narrowly into the key figures who actually set up the torture program is really what you want to have happen here. So I just want to close by saying that it's not the time to be thinking of the compromises that people need to make because the Obama administration is only willing to go to a certain point. That's not our job. Our job is to insist this doesn't happen again, and there's only one way that I know it's not going to happen again, and that's criminal prosecution.
That was an excerpt from the recent event at New York University Law School titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.